I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Tuesday, the 23rd of August. President Obama is visiting Baton Rouge, Louisiana today to examine the flood damage from those horrendous floods from a couple weeks ago. It has caused more than 106,000 residents to register for assistance from FEMA. As our guest cites in an article that he has written, there are thousands of people who have been displaced. Tens of thousands of homes and businesses have been swamped. The question of the hour that he asks and that we ask, what created the monstrous and deadly dump of rain over Louisiana? With more than 30 inches in some spots in a stretch from August 11. Andrew Revkin is our guest, the first part of the program. He wrote a piece in the New York Times last week, What Fueled Louisiana's Deadly Flood? And he has done environmental reporting for a number of years. He's a senior fellow for environmental understanding at Pace University's Pace Academy for Applied Environmental Studies. His New York Times column is Dot Earth, and he examines efforts to balance human affairs with the planet's limits. Later in the hour, Kevin Trenberth, a distinguished senior scientist in the climate analysis section at the National Center for Atmospheric Research. He was a lead author of the 1995-2001-2007 scientific assessment of climate change reports from the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, and he shared the 2007 Nobel Peace Prize, which went to the IPCC. We'll be welcoming phone calls during the course of this hour. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org. Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show, where we always welcome your comments, and we're on Twitter, and that's @KDunnShow. Andrew, hello. Thanks so much for being with us.
That's good. Good to be with you.
So let's ask you the question that you ask so many who know about this field. What created the monstrous and deadly dump of rain over Louisiana?
Well, it's the simple answer is moisture. The Gulf of Mexico this time of year is warm, and you have systems, turbulent systems developing and moving across Florida sometimes, or sometimes just springing up in the Gulf and coming north, and in this case, there seems to have been an extra element, which was soggy ground, warm and soggy ground, and, you know, Louisiana, southern Louisiana is implicitly warm and moist. You know, it's a state that has a lot of low land, a lot of swamp. So in this case, it looks like this according to meteorologists, I'm a journalist. I just try to talk to enough people and dig in on the science to get the basics, but I'm not running the models. The reason you had such extraordinary rains was that there was not only this moisture coming in off the Gulf and this sort of a vortex, a circulating system bringing it ashore, but you had moisture over the land so that the storm, normally, like if a storm moves in over the land, the dry land below it isn't nurturing it anymore.
Mm-hmm.
You have warm Gulf waters, then you got evaporation, and you're adding more moisture and energy. In this case, there was more, it was kind of self-perpetuating, so that is what led to these really stunning rainfall amounts. NASA, and on the blog, I posted some of these images. NASA did some real-time, they had one particular satellite that was overhead and charted about 3.9 inches of rain an hour.
Ooh.
For certain stretches there, August 11th, 12th, 13th, in that area. And that's enough that, you know, you're talking about epic, historic, by modern standards, rainfall amounts. So when you add that up. And now the other thing, Marshall Shepard, who's a really smart climate and weather scientist in Georgia, noted also that what you've had in the same time is a lot of people have moved in. There's a lot of growth and a lot of cement and concrete and asphalt on surfaces that used to be sponge-like.
Mm.
So that not only you have a lot of rain, but you have a lot of what's called impervious surface, which just means, you know, roadways and things like that. And that exacerbates the flooding. So that's why so much rain, you know, this is bound to be a bad flood event, but it became an epic flood event for those two reasons.
Mm-hmm.
And then you have the whole question about climate change. You know, how much of this was exacerbated by the fact that we have a warming planet, warmer air, as you'll hear from Kevin Trenberth. can hold more moisture. And that can mean, so when you have the conditions are right, you can have more rainfall from the same event. And mm-hmm. that's in the mix as well. But when you add these different factors together, it's always hard to point to any one storm and say, oh, that it's almost to me a distraction to say how much of it was global warming or not. Clearly, the climate is changing, and we know that scientists have determined very clearly that in a warm world, you'll have more heavy rain because of that moisture-holding capacity of the air.
Don't we want to know, though, how much of it is caused by global warming, because it gives us more of a sense of urgency about doing something about this now?
Well, yeah, I mean, to me, there's two messages always. You know, I've been writing about global warming since for too long. My first long article on global warming, including on the rainfall risks and stuff, was 1988.
Oh, my gosh, really?
That was just the same year that the IPCC, that intergovernmental panel, got formed. And I wrote my first book about global warming in 1992. And so I've been at this a while. And I think the first question is, what causes vulnerability to things that we care about? And in this case, you know, you're talking about 100,000 people put out of homes or more, you know, damage and deaths, 13, I think, at the last count.
Mm-hmm.
Not to mention ruined crops and all that stuff. So the first thing you want to know if you're a governor or a mayor or a president is, are we vulnerable to climate hazards? That's number one. What's in the mix there? And then the second question is, with what we know about what's coming with global warming, are we vulnerable to that? And then you say, well, what can we do to reduce global warming? That's definitely one important question that emerges. But the real-time question is, what can we do to reduce our vulnerability to heavy rain?
Mm-hmm.
Because that's there. That's implicit, you know. And that's something you can do something about right now. One of the hard things about global warming is that there's a lot of heat and already baked into the system. There's a lot of momentum in the climate system, so that there's very little, and these climate panel reports have found this to be true. Even if Jill Stein got elected, which I don't think will happen, but
probably not.
You know, she has a very, very aggressive, like Bernie Sanders kind of approach to these issues. Even if someone like that was president of the world, not just the United States, you would have no perceptible impact on climate patterns, sea level rate of rise for decades because of that momentum. And that's one reason why, again, as I circle back to the vulnerability reduction right now being a critical question, even as that longer challenge of blunting the rate of warming and is addressed as well.
Mm-hmm. You talk about, and I'm wondering how many of these climate assessments there are and how they're done and what is taken into account when they are done. You write that the South was not among the areas identified in the 2014 National Climate Assessment as most at risk from more downpours. How was that missed and how was that assessment made?
You'll hear some of that from Kevin. I'm pretty sure he's involved with those. They're basically looking at published research that shows what's known, again, about what drives rainfall rates in different parts of the country and what's known, or at least known with some probability, some confidence, about how a warmer climate will change patterns in particular regions. It gets really hard when you get regional in trying to ask climate change questions. Mm. It's always really tough.
Mm-hmm.
The specifics for why the Southeast or the Gulf area was not thought to be an area you would look at for a signal, you know, a clear signal that warming will change the precipitation rates. You might ask Kevin that question. That's a little granular. But the thing that's pretty clear is there's a way to assess the general patterns, like in a place like California, very different than the Gulf, where you have a sense of what drives rainfall there, and you can sort of look at what's known about how a warming climate and changes in the oceans that are expected would change precipitation patterns in particular places. It just gets harder. This is one of the tough realities of global warming science, and some of the leading climate scientists will agree that we're at a funny point where every mayor and governor and, you know, citizen wants to know, well, how's this going to affect me here in Wisconsin or here in Alaska? And it gets harder there. That's where it's like harder. And that's also what gets me back as a reporter to asking the vulnerability question. What can I do to reduce vulnerability to the bad things climate system can do here, wherever the here is? And that's an easy question to answer, you know? Ellicott City in Maryland that had that unbelievable deadly flash flood a few weeks back before in Louisiana, that was an area where you knew there, I think no one ever had dreamed of a, I don't know if you or your listeners saw some of the YouTube video.
No, I didn't.
Of cars, just streams of cars. It looked like, sadly, it looked like the tsunami in Japan, you know, where just cars were being picked up and hurled down the middle of the street with people clinging to them. It was truly scary. Now, so obviously that was epic, just as this was. But that is an area that you look at the flood maps and you could see that that main street, that main drag there was right along a river. And you would want to think ahead if you're, again, the mayor or emergency management planner, what can we do to shift building practices here to make things less vulnerable if the worst happens.
Mm-hmm.
And by the way, this is a discussion that is just as relevant in the wildfire
I was just about
areas
to bring
of
that
the West
up. Right.
That I've written about extensively. And there's sadly, you know, like California has pretty strict standards for building in earthquake zones, which is an implicit, you know, hazard of living in certain parts of California. But there's no real standard, actual, you know, legal standard for building in a wildfire zone. That's kind of left to the homeowner. And there you have, unfortunately, lots of variability in how people build and how they manage their property. And that, so again, you know, climate change is an epic challenge on a very long time scale with no quick fix. But there are some really quick fixes you can do in any community right now to reduce vulnerability to the kinds of hazards the climate system can throw at people.
And what about the people who are affected, the people in Baton Rouge, the people in the areas of California, the people in Maryland who are directly affected, the people in New York, or the people in all kinds of places that have had these horrendous wildfires or floods? Once something has happened in a community that's terribly scary, where you may lose everything, do people take action in the areas that you were just outlining?
Well, this is where you get into, you know, the fact that we don't live in a world where everyone has equal capacity to either withstand or respond to a tragedy like this. If you're poor, you can't just sort of... I haven't seen the figures yet, but I guarantee that a lot of the people in Louisiana whose places were destroyed, especially their renters, did not have renter's insurance or did not have flood insurance, and they're kind of stuck, and that's where their need for some kind of federal or other assistance will be great. If you're wealthy, you know, and you have a good insurance policy, you can rebuild. This is where federal policy and other kinds of policies can start to play a role. In floodplains, you know, there's federally funded, there's federal flood insurance, which, again, this is an epic event in Louisiana. You know, I haven't, again, the flood maps would show which of these flooded areas were already in a known flood zone and which were kind of like adjacent to them. But you would not want to have a situation where there are federal policies or subsidies that are essentially helping people build in harm's way.
Mm-hmm.
And sadly, in both fire zones and flood zones, we still have laws on the books and a sort of federal... handouts. Some of them are not like a concrete handout, but they're sort of a subtle subsidies that foster the kinds of behavior that actually increase vulnerability just when you want to reduce it. So looking for those things is really, really important. But this is where the politics gets tough, and you know, I wouldn't want to be in a politician's shoes. I don't know if you recall, several years ago, Congress did the perfect thing. They finally... There was bipartisan support for essentially raising the cost of federal flood insurance, so that people were paying a premium that more reflected the risks that they would be, you know, facing in a certain flood zone. And that was amazing. It was an amazing achievement because Republicans and Democrats agreed, you know, we're running out of money in this program. And this is the Biggert-Waters bill. I think it was 2010. And great achievement. But then once the people started getting these bills for higher insurance premiums, citizens of every party started yelling at their elected officials.
Sure, right.
And they repealed the most valuable aspects of that law got repealed. So it's like, wow, that was tough to watch because, by the way, I write for the opinion side of the Times, so I can kind of, you know, say what I think. And that was just kind of, it showed you the paradox that can be out there sometimes where you know what's rational, but then you know what's politically rational, and those don't always line up.
Yeah. What have you heard, Andrew, about FEMA's response to Baton Rouge?
I haven't heard any sort of stories similar to Katrina yet. It sounds like, I mean, this, unfortunately, one of the issues here was this, because it wasn't a named storm, you know, it wasn't like a tropical storm on the books officially, as it kind of caught a lot of people by surprise. Not weather forecasters, and as you might have seen in the piece I wrote, there were people warning this is going to be a big deal, but it didn't have that force of... you know, the force of being a newsworthy thing you could have a name for. And so that, but from what I saw so far today, FEMA tweeted there's been $127 million put forward so far toward displaced people. I'm sure that that's a fraction of what's needed, but I haven't seen sort of FEMA scandal kind of Twitter flow quite yet.
Mm-hmm. It must be so horrendous to be in that situation, mustn't it? You think of all these people and you see them on TV and hear them on the radio. They've lost everything. What do you do when you've lost everything?
It's pretty unimaginable. We've had some epic floods where I live in the Hudson River Valley north of New York City, and Floyd, Irene. These are storms that had their worst impacts not in New York City. They were before Sandy, and the impacts were mostly up inland. Terrible outcomes for some people, but a tiny fraction of what you see in a case like this or Ellicott City. Or you may remember earlier this year, West Virginia had an unbelievably devastating once-in-a-thousand-year flood event that killed many people. And is still be recovering in those communities. It'll take years to recover. Same mm-hmm. thing here. It's just hard, you know, It's unimaginable. And by the way, of course, these things happen pretty unremarkably in places like Bangladesh and parts of sub-Saharan Africa where you have either severe drought or epic flooding, and they don't make headlines. So it's there, too. You have even more vulnerability, which is something I've written about off and on, and it's even more of a sense of... it's hard to imagine.
I wonder how many times you've had to use that phrase, once in a thousand years, and if we're seeing more once in a thousand years events, and if those are related to climate change.
Well, this is one of the things. Yeah, we've had around the country, I think it's eight or so, one in a thousand year dumps of rain this year. The behind that statistic, it gets complicated because it's calculated on for a particular place, once in a thousand years for Ellicott City or once in a thousand years for Baton Rouge, as a way to portray the odds, how low the odds are. But it's not like you can always just simply say, "Wow, the country had eight one in a thousand year storms." That means something fundamentally new is going on. It's hard. It's harder to get to that level and say this is a fundamentally new thing. One thing that opened my eyes was in 2002, I wrote about a study in the journal Nature where they looked at, drilled into lake beds around the Northeast in New England and upstate New York. And these are lakes that were chosen because they have a good record in their mud at the bottom of heavy storms. When what happens is essentially, like in Vermont, you have a lake bed, and over the years, each year, there's a little bit more mud in the bottom of the lake. And then every once in a while, there's gravel. And that's because there had been a scouring flood. You know, the hills around the lake were so severely hit by rain that that you end up over the lake getting washed in with sediment. So you have like mud, gravel, you know, over several thousand years. And that gives you a record of past extreme rains. Mm-hmm. And what they found was in the Northeast, there have been patterns of more severe flooding when you look way back through a couple thousand years than the patterns in recent time, which is a humbling thing. You know, science helps understand what's going on in the world today, but you have to place that in the context of what's possible by looking back and then use models and other knowledge to get some sense of what's going to happen in the future. So every time insights like that emerge, it gives you more of a sense of being sure that we're putting today's extremes into the full context of what had been extreme, you know, before there were people with hydrometers and thermometers and the like, taking regular measurements. And lakes actually, and shorelines, I've written about this in terms of hurricanes. You have a sort of a salt marsh behind a coastal beach, and when there's an epic hurricane, it washes sand over the salt marsh. And the same thing, you get mud, sand. And this is called paleotempestology. There's a whole field there. Oh. People can Google for that odd word, paleotempestology, and your listeners can learn about what's been learned about past epic storms. It's fascinating. Mm.
Or they can listen to your podcast, right?
That's right. We did get into this in that podcast, which is with a couple of with a scientist, a meteorologist, and a climate scientist. We've been having fun having those discussions.
And they're important. Let's take a couple phone calls for you, and then we will change guests. Same topic. Kevin Trenberth will be joining us momentarily. Distinguished senior scientist in the climate analysis section at the National Center for Atmospheric Research. We go to Rhonda in Fond du Lac first for you, Andrew. Hi, Rhonda.
Hi. Yes. My heart goes out to them, the people that have been displaced, because we kind of had the same, kind of a similar situation when Charlie went over. My folks have a home on Pine Island in Florida, and the Eye of Charlie went right over the island. Well, it displaced so many people that have lived in these homes for so many years, and, you know, they didn't have flood insurance, and they didn't have no means of going back and rebuilding and ending up having to sell their land. And all these, well, I hate to say it, richer people pulled in and bought their land and built, and it's really changed the outlook of that whole island.
Yeah, that's terrible. Yeah, and it's a pattern. It's as you just have explained. This is hardly unique to Louisiana. That there's two kinds of communities or people that tend to live in harm's way, and this is true overseas too. Very poor people who have no choice but to live in a floodplain or zone of risk, like in Venezuela in the slums, or in Brazil. The poor people live on these steep slopes that are vulnerable to mudslides and heavy rains, and then you have the wealthy who live on the edges of places where they have a nice view and where they know the land is vulnerable, but they get to rebuild, or as you mentioned, in that community, they get to kind of swoop in. That's an even worse outcome. It's just, and how do we, how does the country or any country sort of have a more rational policy? I think you start with vulnerability reduction, making sure people know what the risk is to the extent possible, and that the government isn't subsidizing, again, bad behavior. Same thing, by the way, in tornado zones. I've written about this, with all of our hydrometeorological issues. And then just making sure people have the information they need so they can make a choice. When they can afford to, at least. And then, the biggest policy is making sure we have a prosperous country where people aren't forced by poverty to live in situations that are marginal.
Mm-hmm. And one more call for you. It's Earl in Medford. Hi, Earl.
Hi. I heard you about Alaska, and I was up in Barrow for about 20 years, and the elders, the Inupiat people, testified for years that this erosion was going on and they were losing a lot of their communities and artifacts, but it was never fully accepted by outlying interests in that, and the people are still suffering and losing homes and parts of schools and things like that.
Yeah, and I've written about that before as well. I was in Dead Horse a long time ago, way up there, writing about climate change impacts on land. And there's so many issues in Alaska related to this question. One is that some of the native settlements there weren't settlements until they basically Canadian or U.S. governments forced people to settle in places that were always, again, kind of marginal, you know, and that's a sad part of the story as well. And then with climate change, for sure, Shishmaref, just I think last week, they voted.
Yes, I read that.
They are going to spend the money to move their community away from this sandbar they've been on for 100 years or so. And this is kind of, you'll be seeing more of that. Some of the drivers of that erosion are there implicitly. Some are a function of rising sea levels, and sea levels are rising for sure. The rate at which they're rising, is, at least through the next century, is still unclear, but no one is saying sea levels are falling. And that's, so I guess the answer to the question is just yes, this is an important part of what's going on, and more to come.
More to come, more for you to write about. Andrew, thank you so much for being with us.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thank you for having me on.
We hope to have you again. Andrew Revkin, Senior Fellow for Environmental Understanding at Pace University's Pace Academy for Applied Environmental Studies. In the New York Times, his opinion column is .earth. And he also has a podcast for those of you who are interested, and that includes probably everybody listening. If you're interested in this whole area of climate change, he has a podcast where he is talking with two other people. Let me see exactly who's without their names. One's a meteorologist who does blogging, and another a climate-focused ecologist. And their podcast is titled Warm Regards. A distinguished senior scientist will be joining us as we continue our talk about the flooding in Louisiana. How much of this is due to the warming of the earth? We'll find out from the scientist in a moment. And welcome your calls, too. We'll take a lot of calls the next half hour, I promise. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. Email talk at WPR.org. Facebook is The Kathleen Dunn Show. And this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. All right, joining us now, Kevin Trenberth, distinguished senior scientist in the climate analysis section at the National Center for Atmospheric Research, lead author of those reports, Scientific Assessment 95, 2001, and 7 of climate change from the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. And he shared the 2007 Nobel Peace Prize, which went to that intergovernmental panel. He has served on and chaired several national and international committees within the areas of world climate, energy, and water science. Kevin Trenberth, thank you very much for being with us. Hello.
Good afternoon. You're welcome.
So let me ask you what I asked Andrew at the beginning of the hour. What was it that caused, if we know the answer to this, the monstrous and deadly dump of rain over Louisiana?
Well, of course, there's always an approximate cause, which is an atmospheric disturbance of some kind. In this case, a tropical depression. It didn't quite make it to tropical storm status, but at the same time, it acts as a device for reaching out and gathering the moisture in the atmosphere, which was at incredible levels. And then focuses it in a particular area, and in this case, that particular storm moved very slowly. Often we get hurricanes that produce rates of rain which are just as great as this, but usually they move through an area much more quickly, and so the rain gets distributed over a much greater region. So the key thing here really is the environment in which this storm has formed. And one of the key aspects to that is the sea surface temperatures in the Gulf and especially in the North Atlantic, because a rule of thumb is that any storm reaches out about four times the radius of the rain area that's occurring to grab the available moisture in the atmosphere and sort of draw it in to the storm itself. This is true for hurricanes, and it's true even for thunderstorms and everything in between. And so the moisture actually comes from quite a long distance away, in this case from well out over the Atlantic. And in the Atlantic at this time of year, there is a weather system called the Bermuda High, the Bermuda High Pressure System. So that sits off the coast typically, and there's a general stream of moisture that comes into the southern parts of the United States, and where that comes in varies in time. It contributes to the so-called monsoon that affects the southwestern parts and Mexico. And at times it comes right up in through the Gulf and into the southeastern parts of the United States, depending on the available weather systems. And so that is always sort of pumping a certain amount of moisture into the southern parts of the United States. And then we have this storm that helps to gather that together. And the thing that's incredible was the amount of moisture that's in the atmosphere in this case. It was measured as much as 2.8 inches of water vapor in the atmosphere. That's an incredible number. You know, a normal number for much of the United States and an annual mean value is about 1 inch of moisture in the atmosphere. And so these numbers were incredibly high, and that, of course, gave rise to the rainfalls in some places over 30 inches and indeed one in a thousand year rainfall events occurred. Mm-hmm.
I asked Andrew about this, and he said that you would be able to give us more specific information. He wrote that he was looking at the area and asked scientists to look at the area to see how consistent this storm was with climate change projections, and noted that the South was not among the areas identified in the 2014 National Climate Assessment as most at risk from more downpours. Why wasn't it?
I don't know without having a look back at that. I mean, that's certainly not true with regard to hurricanes and tropical storms. For some time now, certainly since Katrina and beyond, there's been a fair bit of research which has highlighted the risks from heavy rainfall events, and you know, there've been quite a number of these. A previous one, which attracted a great deal of attention, I think it was 2011, was Irene. You know, that one got a name, and the thing about that was it started off as a tropical storm, but it stretched all the way up the sort of the eastern seaboard areas up to New England, and there was tremendous flooding over huge reaches of the country, and so we've certainly been well aware of the risk that increases in heavy rainfalls, especially associated with tropical storms, but actually all kinds of storms, and this even applies to winter. And so you can go back to midwinter storms where there are heavier snowfall events, such as occurred on the East Coast earlier this year, that led to, 30 inches of snow. I remember the pictures of the panda in the Washington Zoo.
Yes.
And shutting down Washington. So that's part of the same phenomenon, that there's higher sea temperatures, which is partly due to climate change, that means there's a lot more moisture available over the Atlantic, and that gets sucked into the storms, and it can produce heavier snowfalls in winter, and it can produce much heavier rainfalls in the summertime.
He wrote in his article, and I'm wondering if there is a lot of talk among people in your profession about this, that it still remains difficult to find a signal of greenhouse-driven climate change in these kinds of storms, or even in patterns of rare heavy downpours. Is it difficult?
The way in which we have divided this up to try and make more sense about it is to treat the actual individual phenomena and the what we call the dynamics of the storm, all of the weather aspects associated with the storm, as being somewhat separate from the environment in which these storms are actually occurring. And the environment in which the storms are occurring is systematically warmer, and it holds more moisture because the atmosphere, as a rule of thumb, holds more, can hold more moisture, about 4% for every degree increase in Fahrenheit temperature. And in this case, for instance, there was sea temperatures that were about 3 to 4 degrees Fahrenheit above normal over an extensive region east of the southeastern parts of the United States. And that's where a lot of the moisture was coming from. And so in that region, there was 15 to 20% more moisture sort of lying around waiting to be gathered up in a storm. This is about 15 to 20% more moisture than, say, prior to about 1970. And that moisture is sort of lurking there, waiting to get caught up in any individual storm, and then the storm concentrates it, and locally it can easily double that kind of amount. And so it's those environmental effects which are very robust and which are occurring in all kinds of storms all around the world, and those parts are clearly connected to the climate change aspects.
Mm-hmm.
But when you come down to individual storms and whether there will be more storms or more tornadoes or more hailstorms or things like that, then the situation is much, much murkier and much harder to pin down with regard to especially the climate change influences.
Let's go to phone calls. Our number is 800-486-8655. Kevin Trenberth, distinguished senior scientist in the climate analysis section at the National Center for Atmospheric Research, is our guest now. And we start with Dan in Stevens Point. Hello, Dan.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm sure your esteemed guest here will acknowledge that climate change is having an influence on the amount of moisture in the atmosphere. He would just discuss that to some extent. The warmer the air is, the more moisture can be held in the atmosphere. And we are going to have increasingly violent storms as the years go forward. Here in Wisconsin, we had a 1,000-year flood in northwestern Wisconsin a few weeks ago. It was only 10 to 12 inches in 2 hours, but that was enough to do $30 million in destruction and killing some people and injuring others and hurting our economy. The question is, what can we do about it? There are short-term effects, as the previous scientist mentioned, vulnerability reduction, and that is important. But I'm concerned more about the long-term impact. I'm concerned about intergenerational justice and what we're doing for future generations to enable them to have a planet that is livable. And I wonder whether your guest agrees that the way to accomplish that is simply to get the carbon out of the atmosphere.
Well, firstly, you're absolutely right that there are increasing numbers of these events in many places around the world. I mean, there's been some tremendous flooding in China this year, and there was some in India, and you know, in the U.S. in the past year, there was major flooding in October in South Carolina. There was a tremendous amount of flooding in around Missouri in November and December of last year, three times the normal rainfall for the whole state of Missouri that is normal for that region. The normal is about 5 inches. The previous high that they had at any time was about 10 inches, and they got over 15 inches of rain for the month of November, December last year. And so these are not unique events, and we're seeing them in different places at different times around the world. The first thing to recognize that these are happening, and there is a cause associated with it. The fact is that the oceans are warmer. That's where the memory of climate change is. The atmosphere above the oceans is warmer, and it has more moisture in it, and that gets caught up in weather systems, and it contributes to these very heavy rainfall events. And so the intensity of the rain is much greater, and then exactly how much damage occurs depends on the movement of these systems, which has a large chaotic element to it, a random component to it relating to the weather. And unfortunately, in this Louisiana case, it was a very slow-moving event. So the first thing is to recognize that when it rains harder. When it snows, it can snow harder now. And therefore, managing water is a key issue. The other side of the coin, of course, is the other thing that we're seeing in places like California and up at Fort McMurray in Canada and so on, are the wildfires. In places where it's not raining, things dry out quicker. That moisture gets into the atmosphere and gets transported by the winds to where it is raining. And so there are places where it's also drier, and the risk of wildfires is increasing. And so at both ends of the water cycle, the dry end, the droughts, and the heavy rains are the things that we expect to see and which we're seeing around the world associated with climate change. And therefore, managing water is a major issue, and yet we don't do it well. In many jurisdictions, in many cities, in many counties, in many states, the people who are responsible for flooding, like the Corps of Engineers or the Bureau of Land Management or something like that, or local counties and so on, they have a flood group which deals with floods, and they build culverts and ditches and so on. But they in California, they've been very worried about drought. And so they had some heavy rains in January, and immediately they put it into concrete channels and shuffled it out to sea, and the water was lost. They didn't save the water for the times of the drought. And then people who worry about the drought side of things and the allocation of water are usually a different group. And so managing water needs to be done in a more holistic fashion, in an end-to-end fashion. And the challenge, of course, is to catch some of the water from the times when you've got too much for the times when you don't have enough. And it could well be, for instance, that in a couple of years there will be a drought in the southeast. And that's not a prediction, but it's you know, the odds of that happening are certainly there, because we see that there are longer dry spells occurring in general around the country in between these heavier rainfall events. Mm-hmm. So that's the challenge. And the other aspect, so this is the management part of it, and the other aspect is to stop this from happening in the first place. And indeed, that relates to climate change. That relates to all of these things in the Paris Agreement and the Clean Power Plan within the United States about how we can cut down on emissions of carbon dioxide and the burning of fossil fuels and so on, changing our energy systems to be more friendly to the environment.
And Andrew mentioned that we need to decrease our own vulnerability by being quite careful about where it is that we build and how many places we build in a certain area that might be too much, and so water can't soak into the ground. It just runs off cement.
That's correct, yes. So that relates to the overbuilding in many floodplains. And you know, one of the reasons is that's the area which is less desirable. It's left open. But there has been, unfortunately, in many areas, expansion into floodplains. But there are some areas where people are, you know, being forced to abandon those regions. This is true in parts along the Mississippi, where some parts, houses, and places have not been built back, and along the north coast of Alaska is another case in point, where rising sea levels and increasing storminess has led to jeopardy of a number of places there. But you know, there's always more people and more demand, and people who are unfortunately apt to try to exploit that situation.
Kevin Trenberth is our guest, and we're going to welcome more phone calls for him, 800-486-8655. The question of the hour, which has been expanded a little bit, but as the president visits Baton Rouge, Louisiana today to look at the devastation from the flooding that took place August 11, 12, and 13, huge amount of damage. People, some people died, people lost their homes, and will have a hard time rebuilding. What created this huge amount of rain that fell in this area, and how much of it is related to the warming of the earth? Kevin Trenberth is distinguished senior scientist at the Climate Analysis Section at the National Center for Atmospheric Research. 800-486-8655. To more of you in a moment after the news from, no, not the news, after we hear this message. The news is coming up at about 8 minutes, but we'll start taking more of your phone calls in just a moment here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Let's go next to Rod in Weyerhaeuser. Hi, Rod.
Yeah, hello, Kathleen. Awesome program. Yeah, you know, any of these other have, like, who you just mentioned about poverty, and that's important. But I think he's got to have more on this because, you know, if this climate change continues the way it's portrayed, poverty and schooling and taxes and all that other stuff, family planning, abortion, whatever, you name it, won't mean a hill of beans. Because if we're not here, it don't matter. But anyhow, you know, I when I was a kid, I used to chew on ice. He'd say, don't chew it, you'll crack your teeth. You look at that ice cube, and it was big. It was a mass. And you look away, and it was still there. But eventually, when it got smaller, you look away, and you look, it was gone. So that's what's happening here with the ice caps. And also, you know, it's unnatural to me that all this land has been opened up. Now, people got to make a living. There's no question. But how are we going to do it? That's the thing. Working with the land. I had a number two shovel in my hand when I was probably 3-4 years old. I wanted to dam up everything. You know, there's so many areas that used to be water that are drained. And, you know, it's just not natural. You know, reserves, I mean, these fourth, fifth grade teachers way back, you know, just to the basics, they're making a mountain out of a molehill. All your groundwater, fourth, fifth grade, I learned that. That's from swamps. It seeps into the ground, and these things are drained. So you don't have that, you know, and that's why you got, like, in Africa, they're saying in the Mideast where people are walking for miles and miles trying to find water. You know?
All right. I need to hold you there, Rod, because we have a lot of calls coming in. Let's start with, is this the most pressing issue of our time, Kevin?
Yeah, well, I was waiting for the question there.
Yeah.
And, I mean, he did note that there has been a lot of other kinds of human interference on various kinds of things. And one of them, of course, is building levees. And so this happened especially with Katrina. The Corps of Engineers goes back in and builds certain levees. But once these levees are breached, they can actually cause a lot more flooding than would have occurred if they hadn't been built in the first place. And so sometimes some of these kinds of actions that our engineers and the human activities are producing can exacerbate the problems that are otherwise occurring.
Claire writes on Facebook, aren't flood maps woefully outdated, and why should we taxpayers be paying for flood insurance bailouts and FEMA assistance when Congress doesn't address climate change solutions and state and local officials have poor and long-range land use planning?
Yes. I mean, certainly the U.S. Congress has not addressed this issue. The administration has certainly been trying, mainly through the Clean Power Plan, which is more of a regulatory approach rather than a really comprehensive approach. But the intransigence of the Congress, which is often related to vested interests, is certainly an issue. And so there is no real master plan that's in place to address these kinds of things.
David, and we have about a minute left, everybody, in Madison. Hi, David.
Hi, thanks very much. Just one question. There's been a fair amount of research about the changes in the Arctic with increasing temperatures there, the changes in the jet stream. And I'm wondering, is that research clear enough in terms of how it could be affecting weather in terms of extreme events south of the Arctic, like, you know, what we saw in Louisiana?
I mean, that's a good question, because there certainly have been major changes in the Arctic, and there have been some postulates by a number of scientists that maybe these are affecting storms. I'm more of the camp that thinks these are more a consequence rather than a real cause, and a lot of the biggest effects come out of the tropics, and we've seen that over the past year with this major El Nino event, for instance. It just turns out that the influence on the atmosphere is just so much greater from the tropics, simply because it's warmer and it can hold much more moisture, and therefore the heating patterns in the atmosphere that affect the large-scale waves in the jet stream are much more profound than they can ever come out of the Arctic. But all of them come together to indeed affect the weather and climate around the world.
Kevin, what a pleasure to have you on. Thank you so much for being with us.
You're most welcome.
Kevin Trenberth, we'll have him back if we can do that. He's a distinguished senior scientist in the Climate Analysis Section, National Center for Atmospheric Research. He shared in the 2007 Nobel Peace Prize, which went to the, as you'll recall, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. Thanks so much to KP Whaley for producing this interesting show on the day that the president is assessing flood damage in Baton Rouge, Louisiana. And thanks to KP for on-air production here in our downtown Milwaukee studios. News is coming up now, and then we will return and have a very important conversation about an area that's overlooked, the poverty industry, the exploitation of America's most vulnerable citizens.